Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today a guest from California, a member of the California Appellate Bar, MC Sangaila. Welcome, MC, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, our listeners may be asking themselves, why are you having a California lawyer on the Texas Appellate Law Podcast? As we were chatting a bit before we hit record, we actually have had a number of non-Texans on the show, and it's always interesting to draw comparisons and contrasts between state practices. But before we launch into that kind of topic and some other things we definitely want to talk with you about, why don't you tell our listeners a little about yourself, where you've practiced, and your current practice situation?
Sure. So I have focused on appellate law for over 25 years now. I've been a lawyer for almost 30. And I had two clerkships, a district court clerkship and a Ninth Circuit appellate clerkship coming out of law school. And I did some litigation first at Irala Manella, focused on white collar criminal defense, a business litigation. But then I found my true love of appeals and I left to go to Horvitz and Levy, which is an appellate boutique here in California. And I was there for almost 14 years. And then I moved back to my home in Orange County, California from LA. And I was at Snell and Wilmer and then Haynes and Boone. And now I currently chair the firm-wide appellate practice group at Buckhalter.
Those are some names that I'm familiar with as far as the firms you've been with. Certainly Horvitz and Levy, we have an established appellate bar here in Texas. And if you look around at who's doing that kind of thing in other states, I know that Horvitz and Levy is definitely at the top of the rung. I also know Snell and Wilmer, but I kind of think of them, maybe this is not accurate, but most of my experience with them was in Arizona. And so I don't know where their home office is, but that's certainly a good firm. And now you mentioned Haynes and Boone, of course, everyone who listens to this episode is going to know that firm. I guess your Texas connection, is that right?
That is my Texas connection. There might be more, but that's definitely one of them. That Mark Trachtenberg was on this program earlier, very earlier in its life cycle. So that's how I actually first noticed your podcast was from Mark's appearance.
Well, we think a lot of the Haynes and Boone appellate group, they're an outstanding group of lawyers. And I don't think of them as, I really don't think of their offices outside of Texas very often, but it's interesting that, you know, to hear a little about their California connection. As I suggested, as I highlighted at the beginning when we first started talking, it's always interesting to do a little compare and contrast of other jurisdictions and how they do things compared to how we do them in Texas. I do know that, as we've talked about on the show here a little from time to time, you know, we have a board certification process. We have an appellate specialty that's recognized by our state bar here in Texas. And I believe California has basically the same thing. Is that right?
Correct.
Y'all's bar situation. I'm also very involved in the state bar of Texas. And I know you've had a mandatory bar, and now you've got a different organization that's running the CLE part versus the discipline part. Maybe we don't have to get into the details of that, but there's been a lot of, I guess, dissension among the bar and lawyers in California in recent years.
Well, I mean, it's definitely been a significant change that it was all one unitary bar for decades, going back decades, and then it got separated. And the California Lawyers Association is now the part run by lawyers, and then the state bar is run by administrators, and that's the part of the bar that disciplines us, and the Supreme Court licenses us. So it's split. I think it is a little bit rocky in that transition, and maintaining the opportunity for lawyers to have a voice about how lawyers should be regulated and what should happen with their practice is essential when that happens. And between COVID and the rockiness of totally transferring this decades-long state bar into a California Lawyers Association, which itself, you know, is a little tumultuous, I'm setting up a whole separate infrastructure. I serve on the Appellate Practice Committee of now the California Lawyers Association, previously the State Bar. And I've also been involved with the State Bar Task Force of our local Orange County Bar Association, which is monitoring all things State Bar in terms of how they are deciding to make changes with regard to lawyers with no lawyer input most of the time. So it makes for sort of a whack-a-mole situation in terms of finding out what's going on, and it takes a concerted effort. So yeah, it is very different.
We have had in recent years in Texas, we have sunset review periodically because we're a completely self-regulated, unified bar here in Texas. And now we're facing litigation over whether we should continue to be a unified bar, even aside from pressure that might come from the legislature. There are factions who are trying to basically dissolve us through court action. And so far, those have not prevailed. And there's a number of states with lawsuits that relate to these same issues. So far, it's not been a go in Texas, although there's a case before the Circuit Court of Appeals right now that is going to decide this. And we had a district judge here in Austin, Lee Yackel, who granted the bar's motion for summary judgment, and the status quo has continued. I bring this up in as much detail as I have because I hope to have some of the lawyers involved in that case on the show, at least maybe when the Fifth Circuit argument has taken place. There are fascinating First Amendment issues and all kinds of things that you really wouldn't expect to see come up in these cases. And so it's interesting to see what California has gone through.
It really intersects with a movement that's happening around the country, which you see in Arizona, in Washington, in Utah, to really transform the way law is practiced, to allow non-lawyers to own law firms, to allow electronic apps to do law. All of this stuff is happening around this, centering on an interest in access to justice. But despite very good desires to do that, there's also, I think, a cascading effect of those potential changes that in many cases is not being fully considered, especially if lawyers and including public interest lawyers are not allowed to have their voice heard about it.
It's an interesting area that, you're right, I think has really developed the last few years. And I know Todd, as part of the state bar, knows a lot more about this than I do, but I've been following that at a very high level. And you're right, you see it kind of in every state. And I think it goes hand in hand with sort of a pushback against a lot of occupational licensing restrictions across the spectrum that's outside of the practice of law as well.
You know, some people lament this, the commoditization of law. And we had another guest on several episodes back, I believe it was Mike Whalen, who said, the law is already commoditized. You guys need to accept it. He's a lawyer too. You know, there are those of us that hold on to sort of, it's hard to talk as much about the law as the noble profession. You know, it is deep down, those of us, especially in that have our own practices, it really is a business. And it'd be foolish to not treat it that way in many respects. But it is difficult to watch, especially as now we're starting to see things that have happened more so in other states start happening in Texas. I think the change is afoot in some way. We're really going to have to get used to whatever this new model winds up being. But it's interesting to compare notes on that.
We can't forget the most important appellate difference between Texas and California, which is the missing S. We have courts of appeals here, and in California, you only have courts of appeal. So you can spot an outsider by the way they spell your appellate courts over there.
That is true, unless, of course, you go to the Ninth Circuit.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Well, I want to point out, I became familiar having done a little work in California years ago now. I've noticed a few of those kind of distinctions. There's that one, and there's the idea of a writ of mandate. Or let's go back, not even to appellate practice, let's go all the way back to the general demurrer. If you went to law school in Texas, you'll know that's one of the things that procedural professors teach you, is there's no general demurrers in Texas. I know that California has them. And honestly, most Texas lawyers don't even know what they are because we don't have them.
I was just thinking that there were two other things that I remember from my time at Haynes and Boone that were very different. Our Supreme Court practice and also the way we do our oral arguments, where there are opinions written before you come to argument most often, and sometimes they're shared or some version of what is thinking is shared prior to argument. And then the thing that always got me about the Texas Supreme Court was that when you sought review, it really was, I mean, we have a whole separate petition for review procedure, and we identify the issues and we do, you know, all of this stuff. And then we have, as a matter of course, a full merits briefing in front of our Supreme Court. So it very much mirrors the U.S. Supreme Court practice. But that is not my understanding of how it works in the Texas Supreme Court. The other thing about the court that was very interesting was that I remember there would be a lot of discussion about what would pique the court's interest in, you know, looking at a case. And those factors were very different from what the California Supreme Court would look to. And it just says a little bit about, you know, what issues they're interested in and how the court views its role.
I think maybe since you were exposed to Texas practice, it's been done a little differently for the last 20, going on 4 years now. We actually have, it's not quite the cert type approach, but it's much closer to that than it once was. We used to have what's called an application for writ of error. And you were doing, you know, the full brief in advance of whether the court was even going to decide whether to look at the case. And now it's more of, you know, you're doing an abbreviated brief with a petition for review and then full briefs on the merits. I'm not sure if I've adequately addressed the differences. Jody, if you had anything to add.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, on the courts giving their sort of opinions or thoughts on cases prior to argument, is that's something that we really have not adopted in Texas, certainly at the Texas Supreme Court. You know, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, and I don't know how the California Supreme Court is, they don't take single issues in cases. They take up, you know, if they grant your petition, everything that goes with it goes with it. And you just kind of have to be prepared to argue whatever that is. And they don't really give a lot of information other than it's been granted on all the issues. I have seen a couple of courts of appeals over the years, although not very often, put out a letter that says, hey, this is the thing that we're really interested in talking about. But no more than that. They don't signal where they are. They just kind of say, we'd like the appellants to be, or both the parties to be prepared to address X and Y. But I haven't seen it go very far beyond that. Have you, Todd?
I haven't, although you hear about it from time to time. And, you know, if you've got a particularly complex case at the Supreme Court where there were multiple deep issues addressed in the Court of Appeals opinion, and those have been carried forward largely in the Supreme Court briefing, it would be nice in some circumstances to know which were the ones that caught the Supreme Court's interest. And so we do every once in a while I do hear, well, you know, maybe the Supreme Court will tell us what it wants to hear about. But no, I haven't seen that done on a widespread basis yet. And I mentioned having handled an appeal in California years ago. That was my experience was, and it was in the Riverside area, was that the court, much to my delight, issued a preliminary opinion before oral argument. And actually, I traveled to Riverside and argued the case with a preliminary opinion right in front of me. And I'll tell you that I've always been interested in that and kind of curious about it, because you think about the ways that that changes the strategy, the oral advocate. I would assume the strategy generally, at least mine was, is, well, okay, I already know what the court's thinking. You know, what do I need to tell the court to get them to sign this opinion and make it the final version? And then, of course, from the other side, it's exactly the opposite, right? It's like, I'm looking at your draft opinion, and let me tell you all the ways that I think you're wrong. Is that kind of how it goes, MC?
Yeah, it's much more in Riverside is very special. It's the only one currently that has that kind of full, you know, approach where they share their draft opinion with you. They share it when they send out the argument notice, and some people decide they don't want to have argument after that. You know, either one or the side that is not winning has decided they're going to take their lumps and there's nothing they can say that will change anything. So it does end up, I think, reducing the number of arguments that people choose to have, because in California, if any one party wants argument, you get argument. It's the very opposite of the Ninth Circuit, which itself decides whether you warrant argument and for how long. So there is that difference. I think that argument, obviously, in that court is very focused on the opinion, on the, and like you mentioned, focusing on specific language or specific aspects of it and always rooted in the opinion itself. That's definitely the way argument goes, which is different from other courts in the state. There are more courts adopting some kind of tentative procedure, whether it's shorter versions of sort of summarizing where they think they're going or sending out questions, you know, a couple of days before argument so that you can be prepared to answer them. And more are, you know, considering some hybrid of that. It's definitely been debatable in the appellate bar. Most of the appellate bar is in favor of some kind of production of tentative or questions indicating where the court is going, because it seems more efficient. If there's some issue that you think is important in the case and the court has decided it never needs to reach it, then it certainly would be nice if you didn't have to spend client time and money preparing for some issue they're just not going to deal with. But my personal view is that I prefer sort of the medium method. The full drafted opinion that's circulated seems to me more difficult if you want to completely move the court in a different direction or a different line of reasoning. My very first appellate argument ever was called in at the last minute after an adverse tentative came in Riverside, and I had to argue against it.
Oh, wow.
Like a personal, you know, history with that.
It does make sense, though. I mean, if a judge has put in the time and the effort to really prepare what looks like a full opinion, I think it would be difficult to change their mind because they really have ownership of that, as opposed to, here's our inclination, here's where we think this is going to go. You know, you put thought into it, but maybe you haven't fully developed it. I think that makes sense. I really kind of wish any Texas judges that are listening, I don't know if we need to have a rule change or what, but this, it would be helpful, I think, from everyone's perspective, both the courts and the advocates, to maybe have a practice where you even narrow down and say, here's the issues we want to talk about at oral argument, because I think it just helps everybody. You know, the court gets to talk about what they want to know about. The advocates don't have to spend, like you said, the time preparing for issues that the court's not really interested in. Although certainly if they wanted to talk about that, they could choose to. I think it really does kind of foster efficiency on all sides.
In California, every court of appeal and the Supreme Court has some version of a tentative opinion drafted by the time you come for argument. The difference in Riverside is that they share it with you. And I do think the logical difference in publicly sharing, you know, all of your work product instead of having drafted it, then going back to your chambers and editing.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
I'm thinking of a case that I just finished up where I was on the appellee side and my opponent, it was a jury trial, appeal from a jury verdict. And my opponent submitted 64 issues to the Court of Appeals, which there was a lot of overlap, as you can imagine. But, you know, when that case gets argued, it would really simplify my preparation and cut down on the time a lot, I think, if I knew which issues the court wanted to focus on. As you can imagine, with that many issues, they go all over the place. And so it's not necessarily applying the same standard of review. I mean, it could be almost anything. And trying to prepare for a 20-minute oral argument on 64 issues is like, you know, you're back to studying for the bar exam or something. It's like, what are they going to ask me? Because, you know, our panels, I'm sure it is this way, as I recall in California, you know, you're not going to be given a 20-minute speech and you're going to get hit with the hard questions right out of the gate. So I hope, Jody, that this actually does help generate some discussion about this as a concept in Texas, because I'm all about efficiency. I don't like waste. And, you know, we've talked about how the legal market itself is starting to kind of tighten up and people are looking at this from a consumer standpoint of what value am I really getting for all the cost that goes into this? And then you mentioned MC earlier in the conversation, maybe it was before we started recording, but you know, we talked about a little about access to justice and eliminating the waste that so often comes with the legal process would really go a long way toward making the system better and therefore increasing access to justice, I think.
I have a question about the Texas Supreme Court. Do you court take a number of issues that might be certified or that they're asked to take from a federal circuit court?
They do generally. You know, they have a pretty collegial relationship with the Fifth Circuit. In fact, one of our more recent Fifth Circuit justices came straight off of the Texas Supreme Court, and then the current chief judge of the Fifth Circuit came off of the Texas Supreme Court. So they've always had a pretty robust certification process. And I think that part of that is because the Fifth Circuit really doesn't just certify things to certify them.
The Texas Supreme Court recognizes that it's something that's worth taking up.
Mm-hmm. It seems like we see one or two a year on average, and they just sent one and the Supreme Court accepted it within the last month or so. It does happen pretty regularly. Well, one of the main reasons that we wanted to have you on the show, you were gracious enough to reach out to us and approach us about coming on to talk about a topic that you care a lot about. And it's related to appellate practice directly, but it's not the nuts and bolts of appellate practice specifically. And that is the training of the next generation of appellate lawyers. What gets you started? How did you get interested in that as an experienced lawyer?
Well, I've taught in law school clinics or law school appellate advocacy classes at various law schools, from Whittier Law School to UC Irvine and now Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. I've taught as an adjunct in those for over 10 years now. And so I have a lot of exposure to students in that regard. And then I think, frankly, gentlemen, at a certain point in your career, when you've been doing things for a very long time, you start thinking about, how do I keep this going? And how do I make sure that we have, you know, a really good cadre of people coming up in the ranks? So I think it's that combination of timing in my practice and my experience with students through the clinics and appellate teaching at law schools.
I understand you created a new program at your new firm focused on, I think we even called it appellate fellowships. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about how we provide training and opportunities. I think that appellate law is unique in a couple of different ways. One is that it takes us a very long time to really get our craft going. And then on top of having the craft perfected, there's an additional time on top of that for people knowing that you've reached that point. So I remember when I first started at Horvitz & Levy, and you know, Ellis Horvitz would tell me that there's a time delay with being an appellate lawyer, being able to bring in business and being able to have an independent name or being known as an appellate lawyer, because it does take a long time to get good at it. And then the second part of it is that your cases take so long. So you might be doing this super juicy case, but nobody even knows that case exists or that there's an opinion for 2 or 3 years. So there's already a time delay on that. And most people want to hire people who have experience, and they're not going to hire a first or second year attorney to do their appeal. So all of those things combined make it a very old fashioned, long-term, you know, game for anyone who wants to do appellate law. And it could go off track at any point in that system, which I think is probably about 10 to 12 years. So I've been thinking about how do we encourage people to go into appellate practice, because if you don't come out of a clerkship or have some kind of litigation experience, then it's very hard to get hired by an appellate group in a law firm or an appellate boutique. And how do you kind of bridge that? And there are more and more lawyers who are not going immediately into clerkships. So this is a appellate fellowship program that no other large law firm has done in the country. Horvitz & Levy has a fellowship. Gupta Wessler, which is a plaintiff's appellate firm in DC, has a fellowship. And there may be some others in other places. So appellate boutiques have fellowships, but no large law firm had one. And I thought we would be the first to do it. It's named in honor of Marcus Kaufman, who was on the California Supreme Court and started the practice group at Buckhalter 30 years ago. So the fellowship is designed for newly graduated law students or a student who may have, you know, a district clerkship under their belt, but is looking to in the future go for an appellate clerkship. And so it's 1 to 2 years, and it's an opportunity to learn alongside the appellate group and learn skills and catapult them into a clerkship if that is what they want to do. And then either they can come back after that or they can, you know, go elsewhere. But it's meant to bridge that gap for law students and those who are seeking an additional clerkship. And my time teaching in law schools, I've seen some people who are kind of appellate ready even before they have a clerkship. There's not many of them, but there are a few. And so there really was not a place for them. And so we decided to provide it.
What kind of things do they do? I guess first, kind of how do they get into the program? And then once they're in, kind of what do they do once they're in?
Yeah. So I launched the program right when I started at the firm last year. So it's a little bit ad hoc at that point. We might monetize this year, but basically I reached out to a lot of great judges and said, do you have any clerks or externs or know of anyone who might be interested in this? And that's how we got our first pull of applicants, reaching out to judges who are graduates. But so that's how it happened so far. I'm sure we could have a more detailed process, like I said, or it could just happen where someone would recommend someone to us. In terms of the work, the fellowship is designed to expand to the level of whoever is in that role. So it's a couture, bespoke kind of fellowship for each person according to their ability as we see them moving through the program. If one is accelerating, they'll get to do more work. So far, our first fellow who started in November has already done research for Supreme Court briefs. We've co-authored an article that came out in January. She's working on other articles as well. And she even drafted like part of a very big brief, you know, on street issues that we're doing. And she just passed the bar in January. So she'll be able to do more things now that she's passed the bar.
You really get them to hit the ground running then.
Yeah, it's designed that way. It's designed to have them learn as fast as they can learn and get as much experience as they can. Some of the fellowships are more focused on, you know, site checking and co-writing articles only. But like I said, I want to prepare them as much as possible for the next step in their career. And so we want to make that as broad as possible and as much as we can in terms of appellate briefing and research as well.
I know you mentioned you kind of want to plug them into clerkships after a couple of years. So do you have relationships with judges? Are you trying to cultivate now relationships with these people and judges, or you just kind of want to get them the experience and then maybe kind of get them out where they can get to know the judges later?
Well, as I mentioned, some judges are quite supportive of some of the applicants already. So there are some that come with very supportive judges as well as our support. But certainly, if there was an appropriate match, we would do what it takes to mentor and make things happen for people. That's how careers happen and how careers succeed.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. Was there any kind of a commitment to the firm beyond just you're going to show up and we're going to train you and give you this extra bit? I love the idea, let me say. I mean, it's something that you can't get this kind of training in law school. And if you're coming into a traditional associate track at a law firm, you know, if this is being able to focus on appellate practice, if you haven't already had a clerkship, is really, really difficult. And so what's the firm's I don't want to say angle or, you know, take on this, but I mean, it's clear that you've come in, you've seen the need and you've gotten the firm support, and I'll certainly commend you for that. I think this is something we could certainly look at here in Texas as adopting, and you may be hearing from some of our listeners on how to go about doing this. But I guess that is ultimately the question I'm asking, though, is, all right, what's the obligation of these fellows to the firm when the fellowship is done?
They have an hours requirement while they're here, but it's a reduced hours requirement and a reduced pay as well, but a reduced hours requirement because part of their job is to work on publications or things like that that are not billable. So they have a reduced associate number of hours that they bill. And, you know, after the 1 or 2 years, then we have the opportunity to either have them stay on if they don't get a clerkship and they want to continue in it, or, you know, for them to go elsewhere as well. So it's very flexible, like I said, in some degree, because we want to adjust to the person involved.
Do you envision there might be some who move on from the fellowship? You kind of see them as, you're sufficiently trained, you can do this kind of work. You don't need to necessarily go on and do a clerkship to have a meaningful career in appellate law, have them being hired as an associate at that point?
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's flexible. I know, for example, Horvitz and Levy's fellowship, they don't let people stay on. It's for a certain period of time. And if they get hired for a federal appellate clerkship after that, then they might be able to return to the firm as an associate. But that's the only way. And I don't think that's the only way, based on my experience with law students and, you know, training newer attorneys. No, it's possible that they could decide to stay on. It's also possible, frankly, that people could decide, I thought appellate law was something else and I want to do something else. That's possible too. And the good thing is that whatever the training, that training is solid training for whatever kind of litigation or whatever else you're going to do afterwards. You have to know how to write. You have to know how to present things. And that was a role I've played for new litigation associates at large firms previously, is that I would basically be the one who was willing to work with them in their first 1 or 2 years when they were not terribly, you know, contributing to litigators in the trenches. And I would teach them how to write, you know, teach them all of these things. And then knowing that many of them didn't want to do appeals and weren't going to be with me, I wasn't going to get the benefit of that training. I was going to do work, and then the litigators in the firm were going to get the benefit of that. So I've already done that, and I see that that can happen, but I do think that there's very important building blocks from this in whatever you decide to do afterwards.
Absolutely right. I know it's kind of new, but have you instituted any sort of formal types of training along the way, or is it just kind of more one-on-one mentoring as they go along and kind of match what they need to their skill set at the time?
Yeah, so far it's one-on-one. I agree with you, Jody, that I think that more formal training, and I would like to engage, you know, the rest of our senior appellate lawyers in doing some kind of formal training, both for the fellows and for our, we have an associate I also hired just out of a clerkship. So very close in level. I'd like to have more formal training, but honestly, you know, I've hit the ground running at the firm, and it's enough for me to like hire 2 new people, run in-person department, and do my work. So I have to do it, but it is on my list when things settle down a little bit.
That highlights, I think, one thing that this program is designed to get at is mentoring. And your comment just now, you know, highlights a gap in the methodology of the practice of law, which is, you know, you're not, unless there's some internal influence or benefit, you know, it's difficult, unless you just care that much about people, to spend the time to mentor a young lawyer. I'll speak from my own perspective as a sole practitioner. There have been times that I've wanted to hire a younger lawyer. I've had other lawyers that have worked with me, and it's been great, but it usually works best when they have enough experience to kind of run on their own. But then, of course, it's not too long if you've got those people that they start deciding that, well, I can do this, so I'm going to leave. And I've enjoyed watching folks that no longer work with me have success on their own later in their careers. But the idea of hiring a brand new lawyer and the time that it takes to bring them up to the knowledge level, the experience level that it would take for them to be really productive in the private practice of law has always kind of been a deterrent to me, because in my practice setting specifically, and it's true across the board, there's only so many hours, you know, that you can spend on the practice of law. And the pressure on you in a larger firm and the pressure on me in a smaller firm is not all that different, really, because ultimately you've got to contribute to the bottom line. And that, I think a program like this, though, for someone, say, in my position, maybe someone goes and does a fellowship and says, I really like this work, but maybe the large firm setting isn't for me. Well, being able to hire someone who's come out of a fellowship like this, I mean, to me, it's an extra layer from a judicial clerkship. You got that real world experience that would solve a problem that I have, which is, you know, paying to train. You know, I really need them to be productive. I really like this idea a lot. And I certainly want to encourage anyone listening, if you're in a practice setting where you can adopt something like this, I think the underlying message here and the reason why such a program like this is necessary is, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, it is harder and harder to become an established appellate lawyer. And as a young lawyer, it is super hard to get the experience you need to do it. Some of us have come up and had good mentors and really received the benefit of that and helping us in our careers. But I just think the economics of a large firm these days, it's like, how does a young lawyer come out and say, I want to be an appellate lawyer and get any real significant experience early on in their career? It just seems like that's got to be increasingly difficult these days.
Yeah, the other thing in my view the fellowship is designed to address is that you think to yourself, I'm only one person. There's only so many people I can mentor or train. And in the appellate group, you're not hiring, you know, unlike general litigation, you don't have classes of people you're hiring every year. It's a very discrete group of people. And you might hire one associate this year and not have really any other room to hire another associate for 4 or 5 years. And so there's a huge gap between who you can train and when. And so the idea of the fellowship to me was that I'm one person. There's only so many people I can train. But if we have a fellowship where people rotate in and out, I could probably end up training 2 or 3 times as many people overall, which would contribute to the practice in a much broader way than if I just have my 1 or 2 or 3 associates that, you know, are working with us. So that was another idea I had in mind in doing the fellowship, was that I could kind of maximize my impact on training people because there'd be more of them. And similarly, this summer, when I was also serving on the Orange County Bar Association Board of Directors, we put together this online summer appellate academy where we gave the students a certificate. And because it was online, because of COVID, we had students from all over the country, not just in California, who joined us for 4 sessions. And we had appellate judges, experienced practitioners talking about how to get a clerkship or an appellate job, everything from the basics. Ross Guberman talked about brief writing and oral argument. We had a great oral argument presentation. And those have been recorded so that any law students who join the Orange County Bar Association can now, you know, listen to those recorded programs. The North Carolina Court of Appeal decided to do a similar thing last summer as well, putting online essentially their training that they do for their externs, since the externs could not come. And then they decided to open it up. And it was actually that program from North Carolina where I saw a post on LinkedIn about it that I thought, that looks really great. I want to do something like that here, and we'll do it through the Bar Association. And that's continuing. We're going to continue to do that next summer. So that's another way of like maximizing your impact. I may not meet any of those people, but at least maybe we've planted a seed. There's a couple people who have reached out to me and said, I never thought about appellate practice, but now it seems kind of interesting. I'm just trying many different methods to, you know, have a larger impact and to give access to people who might not otherwise think about it or have that access.
What a great resource for law students who realistically are not going to have the exposure to appellate practice in law school in a meaningful way to understand what it's about. I mean, you do kind of have your moot court, your brief writing, you know, you do it, but it's not it's in such a limited capacity that you don't really get to see what the practice looks like. So it's great that you're out there doing that and kind of hearing you talk about your fellowship program. It almost is a little bit reminiscent of like a judicial clerkship, because you bring in a couple of people at a time for a year or two, give them some skills, build the relationship, and then send them off, you know, maybe to come back to you, maybe to go out and train others, but your impact extends exponentially when you do that. That's a really great way to do it.
Yeah. Another project I've been involved in through the American Bar Association Appellate Practice Committee was a couple of years ago, we put together a guide, which is still available online, for pro bono programs in the federal courts of appeal around the country, because that's another important piece in the puzzle, is even if you're getting some experience, you know, practical experience working on appeals, you rarely get to argue. So having someone get their first argument is also another important training aspect. And the pro bono programs are one of the best ways to do that. And most of the federal circuit courts guarantee an oral argument if you take one of their pro bono appeals. So we have a guide on what the criteria are for each of those and who do you approach and how do you get on the list. Those cases are nabbed up pretty quickly out here in the Ninth Circuit for sure. So you have to move fast. But that's another kind of hole to fill in that regard. How do you get them oral argument experience? And that's one resource to look at. And I've always talked to lawyers about that. And I have a very intentional plan for the associates who work with me at each level. Every January, I sit down with them and ask them what it is that they want to accomplish. And I tell them what skills I think they need to have. And then we work out a plan to make that happen. And so at a certain point, one of those things is you really need to have an oral argument, because I need to be able to tell a client, when the client says, has this person ever argued before? I can say, yes, it might just be one argument, but at least I can, so that they'll say, oh, okay, isn't the first time. That's fine. You know, they can do my case.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Texas has a good appellate program for pro bono cases. And that, and I think a lot of the people that take them are exactly for the reasons you said. It is hard, especially as a young lawyer, because you come in and even if you have the skill set, if the client asks and you say, well, no, this will be their first oral argument, you know, they certainly don't then want to spend the time and money on them, because they could have MC with all your experience come argue it. And so pro bono is a great way to get exposure both to the practical side of learning and then also the arguing part, for not the expense of, you know, going through the client process.
Yeah, I'm super sensitive to the pro bono aspects too, because that's how I started my appellate practice, was doing a pro bono case in the U.S. Supreme Court when I was pretty young. So
wow.
Yeah, it's always intertwined. Like the pro bono and appellate practice to me are always intertwined. And I've continued to do a lot of pro bono, both through the clinics that I teach in and outside of that, probably 2 or 3 cases a year, every year. So by now, that's a lot of cases over a 25-year career. So I believe in it strongly as well. I think it's an important thing to give back. But since we're talking about the training aspect, it's definitely an important aspect of that as well.
Well, and what you're doing really does increase access to justice, because you're putting qualified licensed lawyers out there who maybe don't want to be career appellate lawyers, but if you're competent to do an appeal, then you have a whole new crop of people that can take on these pro bono projects and handle that in a way that, you know, someone else off the street might not want to or be able to do.
Yeah, as we were talking earlier, I was thinking about what we had in place here in Texas that kind of parallels what the Orange County Bar had been doing. And I did think about our state bar pro bono appellate program. And that is definitely a proving ground. You know, you definitely get preference for oral argument and through that program, and you get the chance to work, you know, potentially with some more experienced appellate lawyers. And we also have in the Solicitor General's office here in Texas, there is a Coleman Fellowship, where I believe it's a 1-year fellowship program that it's quasi-judicial clerkship, kind of you're going to come in on a temporary basis. You're going to work with, you know, the Solicitor General's office, which has some outstanding advocates trained at the top law schools and clerk for the top judges. And what a great experience that the few people that I've known that have gone through that have had. And it really isn't difficult to imagine basically translating that into private practice setting, which is what you've been able to do, MC. And so the foundation is there. I mean, we've got some things in here in our state that sort of parallel what you all have been able to do in California. But there's definitely room for more.
That is right. The tradition of the fellowship started in the SG's offices, both with the Bristow Fellowship at the U.S. Solicitor General's, and then a number of states, like you say, Texas, California has one now, Utah has one. Not all of them, but there's a few states that have that fellowship in the SG's office. So I looked at all of those, how they're organized. I looked at all of the boutiques that have them, which is, like I said, maybe three or four that I know of, and looked at all of that when I was crafting our program, saying, which parts do I like? Is there a different way we can organize this? You know, what do we want to accomplish? What's our mission in doing this? And I'm committed to remaining fluid in whatever that mission is and what it looks like for each individual person.
Well, my hope in this is that firms from all over the country, or at least in Texas, will hear what you've had to say about it and be encouraged and interested in the development of young appellate lawyers, because, you know, the overall theme here is training up the next generation. And with things being tighter, more difficult to get into this practice area, and with senior appellate lawyers generally working longer, you know, sort of mirroring the trend in broader society, you know, there's more lawyers being trained up, but the work is still scarce. And the highest level work still tends to go to the most experienced appellate lawyers who, you know, some of us would look around and say, gosh, when's that guy going to run? So I can increase my stature, but it doesn't seem to be happening, really. How many appellate lawyers, Jody, have you seen retire?
Not many. I mean, there's a lot of them that are still well into their 70s and 80s.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hope you kept really good notes, MC, because what I suspect will happen is that you may get some phone calls coming out of this conversation, because we're very fortunate and blessed in Texas to have some outstanding appellate groups at larger firms, and many of those are led by women. And this is another area. It's not a gender-based program, but you know, we can all face the reality that we need to make sure that there's equity in training up the next generation of lawyers. Now, that having said that, I'll say that our practice area tends to be much more, you know, gender fair than some others, because we do see a large number of women in positions of authority in large law firms and in the appellate practice sections, and a large number of women appellate lawyers, period. I think there may be reasons for that, that we go a little beyond the scope of our talk, but you know, one of those might be that it's generally seen as a more genteel sort of practice that's a little more predictable in terms of scheduling and lends itself to more stability in terms of the daily life.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I've seen I'm not that old. And during my time focusing on appellate practice, I've seen changes in that regard, not always in the good direction. There were many, many more women, at least in California, many, many more women in appellate practice 25 years ago, because a lot of the incentive to do it was it's interesting work. And yes, you can balance other things in your life, including family. And so you can actually make plans, as opposed to how I remember when I was a litigator, that was much harder to do. So there was that, but as the practice has gained in prestige and the work has become more sophisticated and more large firms have departments as well as, you know, solo and boutiques, I have seen more men in the practice. So there's been kind of either a flight or more men applying for positions that they might not have otherwise applied for, because you know, it may not make as much money as other kinds of practice, but it's certainly interesting and at least has a prestige level to it. And so more men started applying and less women have come into it and less women have led things. You see that at the U.S. Supreme Court level with, you know, not that many women arguing cases, and they're getting trained out of the SG's office largely, again, getting trained by government, not another firm. So there's a need to make sure of that. But I would say, I would push back a little bit on that in terms of, at least out here in California, there are not that many women in high level appellate practice, and there are not that many who lead groups.
One thing that I think has become an increasing topic of discussion throughout the nation has been a lack of diversity in appellate practice. And I know that there's a lot of groups out there that are really trying to push that and be intentional about it. And I think that that is great because that can only increase our ranks and help increase that going forward. And so, you know, it sounds like this is a great opportunity for you to help with that too, because you get to kind of handpick people who might not traditionally call to appellate practice. That's great that you've set this in place.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what you said about the gender gap. I mean, we've certainly seen it emphasized in the U.S. Supreme Court practice recently. I wonder if we can speculate, I suppose, and maybe my thought's not very well organized on this, but I'm a little spoiled, I think, to how we have it here in Texas with a fairly, I mean, it's still a new specialty. I mean, we've been at it for 30-ish years or so, which may be one reason why people haven't really started leaving it yet. But we have had a good representation of women, and maybe we do need to think about, you know, the overall representation of women in the profession and people of color, minorities, to try and develop that going forward. And your program seems like a really, like it would have a lot of promise in both of those areas. You can really focus on who could be shining stars in the area going forward if they're given the right opportunity. But that's the thing, right, is getting the opportunity. And that's what's really hard.
What advice would you give to firms that are hearing this and maybe thinking, you know, this is a great idea? You know, what are some things that you wish you had known, or now kind of having done this a little bit and have it under your belt, that you feel like are important to think about if you're maybe considering starting some kind of program like this?
Yeah, I think what we talked about earlier, having a formal training as well as the one-on-one training would be a helpful thing to add. I think that's something I plan to add, but something that I think would be nice to have from the get-go, that there's something set. I have my kind of apprenticeship model of this week, read this chapter of this, you know, appeals guide, and then we'll discuss it the next week kind of thing. But probably something a little more formal than that would be good. I would also encourage everyone to try and invite, you know, the entire appellate group to become involved in that process of working with the fellow, both so they get exposure to other people and other ways of working and writing, but also it takes a village to raise someone so that you can kind of spread out the time that people are spending training. So far, I've been largely focused on it. So this is my heads up to my team that to get ready, you might be asked to participate. Yeah.
That is exactly right, though. You know, I've been lucky to have very good mentors. Everybody has such a different style. And every advocate eventually has to kind of find their own too. And so the more exposure to ways of doing things can only help you in finding your own kind of unique way and your own voice eventually, because that's what everybody has to do, because there's so many different strengths and ways to be a good appellate advocate, even within the same process.
Yeah, I think about it too as just not just skills, but like developing a culture of excellence for them, that no matter what they do, I think that as appellate lawyers, I always think we have to be, and I tell them this, you know, we have to be better than the trial lawyer or litigator down the hall, because why would they hire us? If we weren't different, why do they need us? And our job, you know, is different, and we have to look at things differently, but we also have to really be focused on excellence of product. And I think that no matter what happens, if someone decides not to be an appellate lawyer after that, having a culture of excellence and care with regard to one's work is always marketable.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think that that is a great thing to remember, you know, no matter what your practice is that you do have to be excellent, and that's why you want to be excellent, so that people can set you apart from others. But I think that's a great lesson for anyone, like you said, to take with them no matter where they go.
Yeah, we usually ask our guests as we wind down an episode to give a tip or a war story, but I mean, be excellent. And all of that is, I think, a really good place where we could wrap up. Is there something else, MC, that you would offer on top of that would fit the tip or war story genre?
No, I think that probably covers it.
Well, MC, this has been tremendous. I'm so glad that you approached us about coming on the show, and you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for doing this and for telling us about what, you know, you've been working on with the fellowship, and hopefully inspiring other firms to do something similar.
I think that's absolutely right. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please send us an email at hosts@techsapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or on Twitter @techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.